Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. On today's show, I speak with Pierre Smulders, a digital and e-commerce expert with extensive experience in the Chinese market. We discuss the evolving landscape of e-commerce, particularly focusing on the opportunities for Australian and New Zealand brands in China and Southeast Asia. Pierre shares insights on the importance of e-commerce as a channel, the cultural differences in consumer behavior, and the necessity of having a solid partner when entering new markets. The conversation also touches on Alibaba's diverse business model and its competitive strategies in the global market. Enjoy.
For Australia, New Zealand, China is, for both countries, by far the most important export market. And exports are hugely important for both those countries because they have a relatively small domestic consumer base, especially in New Zealand. You're talking about 5 million people. Australia is probably about 25 million. It's still small. It's not the huge domestic market you have, for example, in the US or in Europe. So the first thing I say when I'm talking to companies, particularly if they're senior people, I say you've got to have a China strategy. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to enter the Chinese market, but if you're any kind of brand in almost any category from my markets, you've got to have thought about China and have a strategy for that.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Pierre, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be here, and I'm really pleased to be joining this, and of course, really value the relationship also with WPIC, who I guess are the organizers of this podcast.
First of all, where are you in the world that you are joining our podcast from?
Well, at the moment, I'm at my mother's place in the Netherlands, in The Hague. I haven't seen her in years. New Zealand and Australia, well, New Zealand, where I actually live, is really far away from everywhere. So it's, I don't think I've seen my mother since before COVID. So I'm here now, also doing some bit of research on the side, but mostly family visit. And I've just come back from, I've just come in from a week in Dubai and Saudi, which is really interesting. Also, I know we're talking about Asia today, but lots of innovation in e-commerce going on there. And also lots of the Chinese influences and Western influences coming into that market.
I wanted to maybe start with what led your career path up to joining Alibaba of all places, in all places of the world. And then after that, maybe you could throw us a hint at what you're going to be up to next.
Thank you, Todd. So I have a background. I grew up in many different countries. I'm Dutch by nationality, which is why my mom's here. But I grew up in Asia and then did my schooling in the United Kingdom and studied in the States. So, and then I've been living in New Zealand for nearly 20 years. So I have a bit of global perspective. I've done a lot of different things. I've worked in media. I've worked in more traditional kind of business roles, such as strategy consulting. I've started a couple of my own businesses. And really, the opportunity to join Alibaba was one that came about partially by chance through a friend of mine. It was the time when 2016, when China e-commerce was really just booming like crazy. Alibaba needed somebody to really help build the capability and understanding. Initially in New Zealand, my role was focused on New Zealand. And then a few years ago, I stepped into a more regional role. But it was really about, I suppose, riding that wave into China, the middle class, really explosion of the middle class consumer, the rapid growth of digital platforms, cross-border e-commerce as its own specific channel that was really emerging at that time. So, yeah, it was, as you know, Todd, from your background, it's China is nothing if not fast changing and interesting. And I think particularly those years from 2016 through to the challenges everyone faced with COVID were an amazing learning experience and just absolutely fascinating.
It is. I mean, there's a reason this podcast has been around for over 5.5 years. And that's simply because it's always changing and there is always so many things to talk about. But what I want to talk to you about right now is the China market opportunity for Australian and New Zealand brands in China. Can we start with maybe you identifying what the strengths are of each of those countries, both in terms of strong brands and their reputations in the eyes of Chinese consumers?
That's interesting. I mean, I think what you find probably from a lot of countries, and Australia and New Zealand are no exceptions, that the reputation probably started from certain key categories. So if you take New Zealand, it really started with the Chinese middle-class consumer was initially looking for safe food products, particularly infant formula. So we're going back to 2012, particularly when the phenomenon of, and I'm sure many of your listeners will know, Daigou, it's a term for Chinese traders, students, could be travelers. And there were a lot of Chinese students and travelers in Australia and New Zealand, tourists, and they would start bringing back from New Zealand. They would take particularly infant formula, actually also from Australia. A lot of New Zealand brands came out of Australia, and they would bring them back initially in suitcases. Then there was a whole channel, which was the personal post channel. So quite large operations where people in Australia and New Zealand were shipping those products to China to consumers. Australia also, as I said, in that infant formula, but I think whereas if you could say that New Zealand was probably initially driven by infant formula and now much broader dairy and many other products, Australia really, really led with health products and supplements. And I think still from that position, Australia is one of the world's top suppliers of premium health supplements. That's really been driven by the demand from China.
When you're talking to brands about the opportunity, could you lean in on maybe your sales pitch or your explanation of why e-commerce and Tmall in particular was such a good channel for entering China?
Yes. So the first thing I would say, and this is really the case from Australia and New Zealand, perhaps not as important or not something I would stress in the same way if I was talking to an American brand or a European brand, is for Australia and New Zealand, China is for both countries by far the most important export market. And exports are hugely important for both those countries because they have a relatively small domestic consumer base. Especially in New Zealand, you're talking about 5 million people. Australia is probably about 25 million, but still small. It's not the huge domestic market you have, for example, in the US or in Europe. So the first thing I say when I'm talking to companies, particularly if they're senior people, I say, you've got to have a China strategy. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to enter the Chinese market, but if you're any kind of brand in almost any category from our markets, you've got to have thought about China and have a strategy for that. So that's the kind of broad overview. China is really important. People generally realize that. Then you get into why e-commerce. And there's a number of reasons that e-commerce is key. But I suppose if I try to distill it into three. The first is the Chinese market is absolutely vast. So the challenge, unless you are a really big player, New Zealand's case, Fonterra, which is a huge company, American companies like Walmart, you know, set up huge retail operations in China. Unless you're a really big player, it's going to be really hard to get the geographical distribution to reach consumers all over China. So e-commerce is just a very effective way to reach a very large, geographically, economically diverse customer base. The second is that the Chinese rise of the middle-class consumer grew faster than in many ways the retail infrastructure. And this is particularly true in the 2014, 2016, 2018 period. So again, e-commerce was just a really efficient way to reach that because the offline retail infrastructure was you know, maybe not as sophisticated. And the third one, which is again, specific to China and very relevant for Australia and New Zealand categories, is cross-border e-commerce. And there I'm talking about, you know, not cross-border e-commerce generally, that it's something shipped from overseas. But as I'm sure your listeners are aware of, the specific China context where they've created some real regulatory innovation, which is still the case, and they're still one of the only countries, maybe the only country that has done it in this way, where they've really enabled foreign brands to go into China without the regulatory hurdles and difficulties that might occur if you have to meet domestic requirements. So that's, again, really important in infant formula. There are restrictions on the number of brands, the number of products from any particular factory anywhere in the world that can be sold into the domestic retail market, which could be domestic online, whereas cross-border e-commerce doesn't have those restrictions. And health products is the same. To register a health product in China, to get your, they call it blue hat, takes a long time, is complex. But with cross-border e-commerce, you have effectively a much, much more open playing field. So it's really allowed brands to enter and initially test and then build their brands in China. And then some of them, many of them, have then taken, you know, those insights and key products, and they might then move further into the domestic market and even domestic offline retail or domestic e-commerce. So I think if you take those three reasons, China has been an amazing opportunity for so many brands, and continues to be.
And always will be, I'm sure. Now, the negotiation, the name came from our discussions around the purpose of why we wanted to do this kind of thought leadership, so to speak. And it was really, at the time especially, we were really trying to negotiate that information, understanding, cultural divide between the East and the West. It's just where we landed on the negotiation. So there's so much innovation in China's e-commerce space. And here we are trying to bridge Western and Asian markets. What are some of the key differences for you in e-commerce between China and Australia and New Zealand that, you know, and I'm talking about either platform design, marketing strategies, or even consumer preferences that you could point to?
I'll give you some specific examples. So one is just the, and perhaps this is obvious, but it's really important that companies think about this, is the size of it and the size of the opportunity. Yes. Yeah. Alibaba's platforms alone have basically a billion consumers a year, and there's many others. This is not an Alibaba podcast, it's a China podcast. But that also means it's hugely competitive. So the size, you know, comes with pitfalls in that it's very competitive. So give you one number. So when I joined Alibaba 2016, our cross-border e-commerce platform, it's called Tmall Global, had around 3,000 flagship stores. Roughly, you can equate that to 3,000 brands. Some stores might be multi-brand stores. Now it's well over 10 times that in, 8 years. So there's been a kind of exponential growth. In the early days, Australia and New Zealand, for some of the reasons we talked about earlier, was quite strong because it had really led a lot of this Daigo, Chinese traveler trade, postal packages. So initially, maybe some brands who got in early, they could just ride that wave with relatively a lot less competition. But now China has become, you know, really sophisticated. So everything that comes from that is a really, really vibrant, huge online ecosystem, we call it. Lots of innovation always in things like live streaming. China started this whole idea in many ways of influencers selling products. In China, we call them KOLs, key opinion leaders. You know, and that's, of course, now a massive phenomenon in the West as well. So there's a lot of trends that have come out of China that are in the West. And China, I think, keeps innovating because the size of the market, the number of brands, the number of products, I think a lot of the innovations are in how you have to market to consumers and how you attract traffic. And then there are all kinds of other fundamental differences. One of the ones that I still think is a real difference is that shopping is entertainment, and entertainment is shopping in China in a way that it isn't in the West. So the Tmall app, the Taobao app, which is the main kind of Alibaba gateway to all our to all our e-commerce platforms that is visited something like 5 to 6 times a day by a consumer. I'm not sure you would see that on Amazon. And they're often going not just to shop, they're going to browse and to learn and to get inspiration. So this idea of entertainment and shopping is entertainment, yes, is we do see it now in the West, but that's really, really strong in China.
How do you view the opportunity for Australian, New Zealand brands in other Asian markets?
There's two ways I look at this. So first of all, for brands that have already entered the China market and understand how e-commerce works in China, how to do this brand engagement through live streaming, short video, social media, they're often very well positioned to take that to Southeast Asia. The reason I say that is because some of the big e-commerce platforms in Southeast Asia, Alibaba has the Lazada platform there, Shopee is the other big one. Those are the two that operate kind of regionally. And then there are in each country, there tend to be strong local players. Many of them have Chinese roots, Chinese investors, and share a lot of those characteristics. So very often, I find that if you're a brand that has already knows how to do e-commerce in China, and I often say to them, get the people from your China team to be involved in the Southeast Asia launch. But you still have to localize it. So I think it's often the same categories, the same brand messaging to a large extent. The tech in many ways is quite similar. You know, in our case, there is quite a lot of similarities between the tech infrastructure on Tmall and Lazada. Of course, different languages and all those things. But I think a lot of the learnings you can apply. It becomes more interesting if you're not in China or Southeast Asia. And then I think it's really important to talk to partners such as WPIC, talk to Australia, New Zealand. We're lucky that we have very involved expert agencies. New Zealand Trend Enterprise is the New Zealand one, obviously, but the name, and Austrade is the Australian one. And Australia also has state level trade agencies. So there's lots of people you can talk to. So I think it's looking, researching the market, seeing what skills you have within your company and your team, and possibly, as I said, cross-deploying those from China market to Southeast Asia.
Eleanor Roosevelt famously once said, learn from the mistakes of others. You can't possibly live long enough to learn them all yourself. What are some of the pitfalls that Australia, New Zealand brands should avoid when entering new international markets?
Yes, so in China, I think it's learned from others' mistakes, but unfortunately, it's also learned from your own mistakes. And that is all about the ability to respond quickly. And you need to build that capability into your team and the partners you work with. Very few companies, I keep coming back to this idea of partner selection and partner choice, because very few companies can have the capability to understand all this stuff that's going on in China themselves, and it requires a huge investment. Some do, but typically you're much better off to find a capable partner who is doing this all the time with many other brands and has people who are living this day to day. So I think the first thing is, yeah, really learn quickly from your own mistakes. Look at what others are doing. Australia, New Zealand, we're quite lucky, particularly in New Zealand, but I think even in Australia, that generally speaking, if you're not talking to your main competitor that in the local market, and even then they'll probably give you some insights. We have a view in Australia and New Zealand that often we're stronger in foreign markets together. And to the extent you can work together and share insights, obviously you don't give away your deep commercial insights and numbers, but I find there's a lot of collaboration between brands. So talk to other people who are doing it, who have been there. The other big insight, certainly for going into China and also Southeast Asia, is having buy-in from the tech levels of the company. So it's not the kind of market where, the reason I say that is because, you know, a lot of things change and some things you try may not work. And if you have somebody who goes there, they may be an export, head of export, but they're not getting the support from the board or the C-suite or the CEO or the head of international. They really need to buy into this journey that you have to be able to move quickly, try things. Not all of them will work. And it's also might take a few years. It might not be overnight success. There are many overnight success stories, but you can't bank on that. So perhaps, you know, other markets, there is maybe a more defined, if you're an Australian brand or New Zealand brand going to America, there are probably more defined steps you can take and you can almost follow a playbook. I don't think you can do that in China. You have to be much more nimble and change all the time. And you can also find really interesting cases where a brand's positioning in a Western market is completely different. To give you one example, I love this example. It's a premium virgin avocado oil brand from New Zealand. Really, really good brand, really, really good products. In their home markets or Western markets, they are cooking and salad oil, particularly because it's really premium. In China, they fall mostly into the baby food category. And that's something they didn't really plan on when they went there, but consumers were starting to take the products and to put a bit of avocado oil into yogurt and other baby food. And they're now really well known as a baby brand. So, or we call it mother and baby. So the categories you're in might be completely different, or different, from what you're in the West. So your marketing message needs to shift accordingly. Again, you know, having local partners is really important.
Maybe our listeners are familiar with Alibaba for China e-commerce. Probably are. But there are other business divisions too, namely, and you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, cloud, digital payments, international e-commerce. Can you, from your experience at Alibaba, can you tell the listeners a bit about these business divisions and how they connect to Alibaba's overall strategy?
Yes. So the Alibaba group actually started from B2B e-commerce. So many of your listeners may be aware of Alibaba.com, which is a global wholesale platform. Initially, it was actually China was already this kind of manufacturing engine for the world. And in the 90s, a lot of people used paper directories or went to trade shows to find suppliers in China. And initially, Alibaba moved that online. So that B2B kind of DNA still is very much part of what Alibaba does. And it's probably our most global business because we still have the majority of suppliers in China, certainly manufacturers and so on, will be on Alibaba.com and they find buyers overseas. So you that's very much a global part of our business. Our B2C business, the consumer e-commerce business, started about 5 years later when we started an e-commerce app in China. Initially, the real competitor was eBay because eBay was making a big push into China. And they kind of pulled out of the market a bit later because there was such strong competition from ourselves and other Chinese startups. So we actually we started our payments and cloud businesses, or Alibaba. I shouldn't keep saying we because I don't work there anymore, but it was only a few weeks ago. So forgive me if I say we. But Alibaba started its cloud and payments businesses to support the development of its own e-commerce businesses because there was not anywhere else where all this computing power that we needed to drive this big e-commerce. So we had to build it ourselves. And payments was the same. So there weren't really credit cards in China. There wasn't a trusted payment system. So we had to create a payment system to meet the needs of our e-commerce platform. So they grew out of that and then they became independent businesses in their own right because we had built this, you know, really, really world-leading cloud and we had this payment system that had a huge adoption in China. So other shops and services wanted to reach those customers through that payment system. So both of those cloud and payments initially were just to support our e-commerce business, and then they grew from there. And then you know, Alibaba has diversified into many other businesses, which again, many of them come from the e-commerce background. So another one is local services and local food delivery, but that's grown much bigger because we had this network of drivers, this network of couriers. We now deliver all kinds of products that are, you know, still through apps, but they're food delivery and they're restaurants. So they're kind of moving into, you know, sort of Uber Eats type space. But again, it came from our e-commerce DNA. There was a whole entertainment division, but that started from the fact that we were producing content to engage consumers on our e-commerce platforms. And then it sort of grew from there. So Alibaba has become very diversified, but fundamentally, comes from that e-commerce, whether it's B2B, Alibaba.com, or B2C, and then related business have started from that. Some other parts of the ecosystem were more investments, and they don't necessarily follow the platform that closely, but all these other ones are integrated. And in most cases, consumers can access all those services and offerings through one, if they're in China, certainly, through one one login. Globally, we have primarily our businesses, cloud and payments, and then within e-commerce, we have marketplaces in Southeast Asia, Turkey going into the Middle East, Europe, and also South Asia. So it's very diverse. It's a very complex business. And to give you a sense of the scale, you're talking 1.3 billion annual consumers just on our consumer platforms. That's not including the wholesale B2B business. And those are all around the world. So it's very complex, very diverse. But in most cases, they do support each other.
A quick few questions from me that I want to throw at you right now. First of all, have you seen of, heard of, have there ever been discussions within Alibaba that you are aware of doing the type of business along the lines of Amazon Basics, finding those high moving, high search for, high profit margin type products, and then going to an OEM manufacturer and actually producing and owning the entire value chain of that product for themselves, knowing that they obviously hold the reins on promoting it and putting it directly in front of consumers right away when they start looking?
General answer is no, not really. There have been some experiments, but mostly Alibaba is an ecosystem or a set of businesses, particularly in its e-commerce businesses, that enhances the ability of brands or retailers to reach consumers on our platform. So, it's an interesting question. To what extent is Amazon competing with its own customers?
Exactly.
I think Alibaba has largely taken the view that Alibaba is better off empowering its, let's say, brand and retail partners to grow. But there's certainly examples where, particularly with some of the really big global FMCG brands and Chinese brands, fashion brands, that there have been collaborations where they will launch exclusive products and Alibaba will share all kinds of marketing insight and branding. But again, it's actually largely to empower those people to sell more. But those are more just collabs. So it's not so different from a brand launching something with a retailer exclusive to that retailer. But of course, there's all the data insights that Alibaba can share to really power that. So generally speaking, no, there is in some of the, Alibaba has a digital retail business, effectively a supermarket business that does a lot of private label. But even then, it's often done in a collaboration with brands or they might create a joint new brand specific for that channel. So generally speaking, Alibaba, I think, has shied away from kind of graying that line between becoming a retailer in Alibaba's own right and supporting the brands that have made it so successful. So generally speaking, support the brands, support the partners who have made Alibaba so successful. And it's all about the consumers that they're serving.
Can I buy a membership that gets me discounts and next day shipping for free?
Yes, absolutely you can. But again, given that it's China, it's often different. So one of the big things within Alibaba is a sort of premium channel where consumers who spend, actually often it's not so much a membership that you buy, but it's more a sort of VIP level or premium level that you're invited to by your spending. So Alibaba has one which has millions of consumers who get all kinds of benefits. Effectively, like given the Prime, if you'd like to give it that example, but given Prime, they don't pay for it, but it's to encourage loyalty. So it's more a loyalty reward. Within Alipay, If you spend, which is the digital payments network, if you spend a certain amount through the platform, you, for example, when you travel, get better exchange rates. But it's not something you pay for. It's more like a loyalty benefit or something you earn. So it's a slightly different way of doing it. But basically, it's about stickiness and keeping your top consumers coming back. And that comes back to my earlier point that we're trying to, you know, help the brands to sell more. So the more offerings that we can give to lock in those premium consumers, and particularly in a market that's becoming much more competitive like China, where you know, one of Alibaba's differentiations to, let's say, the other big upstart in the last few years is Pinduoduo, which is focused more on the discount channel, is stickiness. So getting customers to come back all the time for entertainment, as we said before. And the second part is, you know, yes, Alibaba has to reach all segments, but it's very, very strong in that kind of mid to top customer, which is really important for global brands who typically are going to come into China and sit at a premium or often super premium level compared to, let's say, local brands.
Last question. Speaking of when you were mentioning entertainment and content, are we going to see something like Amazon Prime on our smart TVs as a Roku app option on our TCL Hisense TV that we can go to watch that movies and TV shows that are actually originals to Alibaba or other platforms in China?
Yes, and that already exists. So Alibaba has a video streaming platform, a kind of a YouTube. It's called Youku, and right. there are many others. But one of the things that China is certainly the e-commerce side is a mobile first environment, and that's definitely, of course, now happening in the West through another Chinese platform or Chinese influence platform. Without getting into the complexities of TikTok, which is not Alibaba, just to be clear, it's a different company. It's ByteDance, and Douyin is the Chinese equivalent. So yeah, mobile first, but that's been in China for a long time. So a lot of the entertainment that certainly Alibaba has been creating, yes, there is some long form, but a lot of it is more short form, brief videos, and that's worked really well into this kind of influencer shopping space. There is Alibaba Pictures, so Alibaba does have an arm that invests in movie studios. But I'm not sure smart TVs. It's not something that I've seen from my perspective. I'm sure there's a part of Alibaba that does that, but it's not a key part of the e-commerce business. It's really still focused on what you can consume through that phone interface, mobile phone.
Yeah. You've just seen it. I mean, obviously Prime Video, a lot of originals, whether it's TV series or movies created over there, Apple, you know, Apple Plus, you know, there's been a lot of entrance into the game. So that's why I was curious.
I think, Ted, I mean, what's interesting there, and this is moving a little bit away from China, it's the question I would ask is, I still, as a consumer, maybe it's different if you're in the North American market where it's so ingrained, but I still don't really get how Prime and Prime Video, if you get a Prime membership, to me as a shopper, the benefit is you're getting faster service, free delivery, et cetera. And how that then fits into a kind of Netflix platform, I don't see the synergies apart from, I guess, just leveraging the consumers. Where I think the Chinese platforms would probably sit on that is, say, it's too separate from the core e-commerce business, and keep those businesses separate. So that's what Alibaba has done. It's really separated its entertainment business from its e-commerce business, because it's hard to see how those two really create synergies apart from just the consumer base. It still confuses me a little bit with Amazon, but then I'm sure it's very successful, but it's kind of a Netflix, but you get it free, I believe, in the States, especially if you sign up to the shopping platform.
Yeah. It comes part and parcel.
Yeah.
And we use it all the time. And frankly, some of the content is really good. So it
absolutely. But how is it related to the e-commerce platform? It's quite vague, don't you think?
I always thought that about AWS, right? And compared to Aliyun, the cloud, right? Mm. That was a more difficult mental leap as well. But, you know, just maybe good business people seeing good business opportunities. And it doesn't always have to linearly tie back to the origination. I mean, I get Ant Financial or Alipay, like those make sense.
Yeah.
But the others are stretches for sure.
Yeah. And would arguably Prime do better if it was completely unbundled from the shopping business and it became much, you know, much more focused on just competing directly with Netflix, for example. I'm not sure. But you know, that might be a better option. An Amazon group could still own it, but just keep it completely separate. Maybe split those two apart. But that's certainly the way Alibaba's got. Alibaba is trying to focus much more on core competencies and taking these different businesses into their own strategies and leadership. And it's gone through a big reorganization to do that. It's created effectively 5 main companies, and many more with some of the smaller spinoffs, because it's wanted each track to focus on its own consumers, and they still certainly will share the consumer logins and so on, but they're really pursuing their own strategies.
Last question, your opinion on overseas expansion of a lot of Chinese e-commerce platforms. Now we're talking about the Temu, obviously Shein. Do they pose a legitimate threat to the incumbents like Amazon in Western markets?
Absolutely. And while to veer away from getting into the geopolitics of this, because that's something that as a business you can't really control, you know, I think a lot of the perception or commentary about creating barriers to these Chinese platforms is potentially protectionist. I mean, a lot of the affordable products on Amazon come from China already. So, you know, it's not that the Chinese suppliers haven't been a big part of the growth of Western e-commerce. It's now that it's just that they're doing it more themselves rather than the suppliers simply using the Western storefronts. In terms of the growth of Chinese e-commerce, AliExpress has been around a long time. Temu has certainly been a phenomenon in almost every market it's entered, and it seems to have entered a lot of markets, but it's been good for consumers because, you know, AliExpress now in Australia and New Zealand has a much better fulfillment because Temu effectively challenged us to do it better. So to that extent, I think this can only be good for consumers because the more competition there is, the more consumers are going to benefit. It doesn't matter really to an American consumer or an Australian consumer or a Dutch consumer. Does it really matter if it's Amazon? If you're in the Netherlands, Amazon's a foreign platform anyway. It comes from the States versus a Chinese platform. It's really about choice and price and all the other things. Yes, reliability. But, you know, I think all the platforms play a role and they're all giving consumers more choice. So my view on this is consumer choice becomes really important. Yes, there are challenges and I think obligations on the Chinese platforms to, I think, sometimes do better in terms of compliance with product safety standards and so on. I dare say AliExpress is by far the leader in that in terms of Western markets, but it's also been there a lot longer. But, you know, those are things that will happen as these platforms mature. And ultimately, I think consumers are going to be better off. So the answer is not, you know, to me, the answer is definitely not to shut them out, particularly in a time where many Western countries are still coming through tough economic times. You know, part of the growth may also just be an economic factor. The timing, Temu was coming at a time when Western consumers have been facing cost of living challenges, high inflation. So it's natural that many of them will gravitate towards a platform that offers really good pricing. But maybe in a few years, you know, if the economies in the West start booming again, they're going to go more for premium platforms, which may benefit some of the more traditional Western retailers and platforms.
Pierre, what are your 3 big takeaways after all your time and experience in China about entering and existing in the e-commerce landscape of that region?
The 3 takeaways actually that I've got that I had thought about before. One is adaptability. So we've talked a lot about how the market's evolving. China evolves faster than many other markets. The second is if you're entering the market, in almost every category, every brand can test this amazing Chinese innovations called cross-border e-commerce. And the third is, and this really captures the first two of the takeaways, is partner selection, because you need a good partner to navigate the complexities of the Chinese and the Southeast Asian markets, much more so than you might need if you were a Western brand from Europe going to Amazon, because, well, Amazon's in your market anyway, so you probably understand it much better. So I think partner selection, working with a trusted partner, is so important. And that's why, you know, for Western brands, especially, but even Chinese brands, having a really capable operational partner who understands the market and can really make these things happen and give you the right advice is key.
And I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's no advice rock that gets hammered on more in the last 5.5 years of choose a good partner to go in with. Don't climb Everest on your own. It's just that's something that we mention over and over and over. And I mean, it's worth it, and it takes some of the stress off. And now you've got a, you know, you're doing it with a partner, you have somebody else to go through it all with you that you can rely on, that you know has done this many, many times before. So could not agree more with that advice. So with that said, Pierre Smulders, thank you very much for being on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
For everybody who is watching online on the WPIC YouTube channel, don't forget we have the audio version, the podcast only, on all your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're audio only and you want to see Pierre and I live on video talking about this, you can, again, go back to the WPIC YouTube channel and watch the full video version there. But, and I also want to mention that 5-star ratings for us are amazing. They feed the algorithm monsters that we need to get out in front of more people that want to listen to our content. So please do feel free to go over and give us a 5-star review, or even subscribe or leave a comment. We would really love it if you could do that. As well, if you have any podcast guest recommendations or somebody you know that you think you'd like to listen to on the show, feel free to shoot us a note over at podcast@wpic.co. We will get your message. We will get back to you. And we'd really appreciate any introductions that you may be able to make. But from me, from Pierre, and from everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.